Hello, book lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. And if you're like me and you get tired of seeing the same titles on every bestseller list, you are in the right place, because on this show, you'll hear from authors who aren't famous yet, but probably will be. Remember, you heard them here first. Today on my show, Portia Alon and her debut novel, Homebound. This is a novel that takes us from 1983 all the way forward to 2586 through a computer game, a story that explores the meaning of love and interconnectedness across time. Later in the hour, on our Book Biz segment, we'll talk to Rachel Cantor, founder and owner of Lovestruck Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We'll talk all about the rise of audiobooks and how they are driving book sales and creating even bigger fandoms. We're going to get started with Portia Alon, author of Homebound. Portia, welcome to Check This Out. I'm so excited to have you on the show.
I'm so excited to be here.
So your debut novel, Homebound, starts with a computer game called Homebound, that is written in the 1980s. It's a game that travels all the way into very far future Earth. It's really a wild ride. Would you read the opening of the book to introduce us to your debut, Homebound?
Sure. So the character in the 1980s is named Bex, and she is 19 years old, and she is at university in Cincinnati. I love the way a computer program doesn't just describe something. It is the thing. Words between people, normal language, is like a glaze over the realness of action and being. A bubble, not something you can touch or count on. But code is the doing, is the thing. Words and syntax and rules creating their own world, their own existence. Everything the code needs is there, inside the computer. I tap this semester's passkey into the door on Baldwin Lab. I get access to the lab because I'm taking freshman computer syntax 101. Although it's a stupid class, I could do most of the assignments in my sleep. This is where I come, though, when I don't want to go home and face Sheila the mother, or when Veronica is busy with Jack.
That's Portia Alon reading from her debut, Homebound. Portia, thanks for introducing us to the book. So you start in 1983, and from there we go forward hundreds of years. Can you tell us what is the plot? What is the book about?
Sure. So Bex is in 1983. She's 19, and she's just lost her beloved uncle, sort of the one person in the world who really made her feel seen and cared for. And he's left her an unfinished computer game that she then decides to finish writing. And we jump forward to the 21st century, to UC Berkeley. We encounter a scientist who's working on sort of climate change technology, wrestling with issues of morality and capitalism and what do we owe to the world and our communities. And then we jump forward again to the 26th century, where we are riding along on a boat called Babylon, with a kind of prickly captain named Yesiko, who is attempting to save the life of her only crew member.
So we really see these three sort of different snippets. And then there's also a thread throughout that is sort of like a choose-your-own-adventure computer game. And we read our way through that, too. How do you describe what it's all really about? Like, what does it mean to you?
The book really started because I was trying to figure out some things for myself about loneliness and about how to feel more connected and grounded in the world. I would say that it is really about finding your way in the world and how to move from being an outsider to feeling like you belong or are a part of something bigger than yourself. And it's also very much about the power of story to connect us.
Right, because stories, there's a robot character, Chaya, who really is the holder and sort of guardian of stories throughout. And I loved that character. Can you talk about her role as the story keeper?
So Chaya is a robot who, at some point in the narrative, ceases to be controlled by humans and so becomes kind of a collector of stories moving from community to community over the course of 400 years. And Haya's voice really just came to me as this sort of folkloric first person plural. And I was like, this is interesting. This is like, I'm curious about this sense of collective memory almost that happens in Haya. And how powerful that is in connecting us to the past, but also how lonely it can be to be the keeper of that collective memory.
Haya's really, for me, was such a fascinating character because Haya was built, constructed, right? But becomes, you know, their own person. And in a sense, right, and, you know, sort of evolves to have sort of their own consciousness and thoughts, but guards these stories and guards the people near them through the whole story. I was really drawn to Haya, which for me was strange because I'm not usually drawn to machines.
You're not the only one who said that to me, that Haya is their robot exception.
Really? Oh, that's so funny. Let's talk more about that. Why is Haya the robot exception?
I mean, I think because Haya's journey is really a very human journey of feeling one, of feeling disconnected and unsure, because Haya at various points is sort of learning how to be. Their sections end often with like, this is the self that learned shame or love or care. And so Haya is very much on a human journey of like, how do I be in existence, in connection with others.
Portia, will you read from Haya's perspective, introduce us to her?
Sure. So this is from 2304, and it's tagged as 147 years since the villa. We had walked beside her mother, her grandmother, and her great-grandfather, and his mothers. Like her grandfather, whom we met as a small boy, the Miriam bore a dark red birthmark on her cheek. She carried a stone in her mouth to keep her tongue from drying. It had been that long since we had seen water. Slowly, she took the stone from her lips and placed it into a pocket. She bent and lowered her face to the lake. When she had drunk her fill, she began to survey the valley below. She read the coordinates and measurements over a radio to her colleagues. In the decades that followed the earthquake, water spilled the banks and wetted itself to the curves of the mountain. A river, and the river brought life to all that it touched. The valley fold of the mountains, like a pair of cupped hands, bloomed. Grasses rolled across the dirt, and the roots knit the soil together. Those small, jumping mountain gazelles nosed through the greenery, and on their heels came the mottled wild dogs who can survive anywhere, but love best the open hills, the chase, the sigh of sunset bedded down in tall grass. Rats and rabbits and moles followed, lured by all the fruited and seeded things that grew from the fecund leavings of the antelope. And birds and trees, so that in the cupped hands of the mountains arose a small paradise. The valley smelled of green, wet earth. What we saw in the wake of the earthquake awakened long-dormant subroutines. We began to assess the concentrations of minerals, densities of soils, the impact of rain and grass and birds and even invisible bacteria and fungi transforming and being transformed. A phrase rose up from our coding, pivot event, an event or cascading series of events that precipitates a change in ecological balance or direction. The phrase felt like a hammer in our hands, waiting to be aimed at the world around us. And from our memory, too, came whispers of other stories.
So good. That's Portia Alon reading from her debut, Homebound. And that's from the perspective of Haya, who's a robot. And we see pieces of Haya throughout history. The book starts in 1983, goes forward 600 years, but it's dotted in between with little pieces like this, where Haya, the robot, sees little sort of snippets of life on Earth and how it's changing. The world in 1983 and the world in the 2500s is very different when you take us forward, 600 years. We're in a water world. Can you just briefly describe that, sort of where we are, how different it is?
So the 26th century world is one that has been really fundamentally changed by climate disaster. And that section really takes place very much on the fringes of whatever society exists in the 26th century. Babylon is kind of a, I don't know, it's like not a very nice boat. It's not a fancy yacht at all. And Yesico is a smuggler, a scavenger. She's a drug runner for kind of a drug lord. And she's delivering things to shanty towns and sort of like places where people are not doing well in terms of wealth or security. And so that is the world that she's navigating.
And what really struck me about when you push forward to the 20th century and then the 26th century in the book was there's this underlying sort of drive or race to space to find an alternative to Earth because, you know, the Earth is flooding and we've basically destroyed Earth with pollution and as humans. And there's this race to find a new home. And Chaya and others in the book are saying, but why? Why don't we save what we have? Why keep looking for more? Let's talk about that message in the book. How did you think about that?
I think I feel a great frustration with our desire for newness and our desire to not repair and fix the things in our world, but rather to just throw it out and get a new one. And that shows up everywhere from, you know, fast fashion to, you know, how we are treating the whole planet. And so I think for me, that felt very fundamental, is fighting that sort of easiness of throw it away, get something new, versus really having to face our responsibility for the things that we've broken or harmed, and then repairing them.
I love the way you frame it and talk about it in your debut, Homebound. Could you read for us from the book?
Sure. So this is Tamar, our Berkeley scientist. Tamar begins the book in the integrative biology department at Berkeley, which is really looking at all ecosystems. And she leaves to work on a project that she thinks will be focused on maintaining and repairing climate damage. And that company is taken over by someone with a really different mission. This is a draft email. It's an email she chose not to send. I am so tired of this attitude. Why are so many of us drawn to throw Earth away, to fantasize about some possible marginally habitable planet, when we have a planet here? A planet the Amis were, in fact, built to steward. I joined Omega because I wanted to help make this world better, not colonize space.
And we really see her, Tamar, struggling with these emails of, I can't believe this is happening. I don't know what to do. And when you lose control of something that you've built, it's so upsetting. And you highlight that really well. If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out. And my guest today is Portia Alon. We're talking about her brand new debut novel, Homebound. One of the really interesting things about this book is that it's sort of written as different parts. They're like different sort of formats that I really want to dig into. You have, starting in 1986, sort of a traditional story, linear, right? We're in the life of Bex and her uncle Ben and her evolution, and it's very traditional writing. And then we go to parts that are written as emails. And then we go to parts that are written as I'm just going to call it a choose-your-own-adventure, but it's the computer game. It's sort of code, but sort of not, because you're taking us through a narrative computer game. How did you think about these different parts? And, like, how did you write them?
So I had a lot of fun with the formats. That was, I think, quite joyful for me in thinking about how can the form match the content in that sort of way that you experience it as a reader, so that the game transcript, you know, is the game. Instead of just describing the game, you get to be in the game. And I wrote them all separately, each of the storylines, and then braided them together.
And I thought that they all came together really well because of this idea of Homebound. It was the computer game, was the string throughout. Are you a programmer? Do you code?
As part of the research for this book, I actually downloaded an emulator onto my computer so I could pretend that I was using a 1983 Commodore 64 and taught myself a little bit of basic programming. But I am not a programmer. My dad is, though, and has been a programmer since the late 70s. So I had a lot of really wonderful conversations with him about what programming was like, in the 80s? And then just logistically, what is it like to use a computer where you don't have a mouse and there's no desktop and you are just interacting via code, essentially, with this computer?
Oh my God, I love this. And I love that you had an emulator. I mean, I'm thinking of like when I put my kids in front of, you know, a payphone, they don't know what to do, let alone an emulator, right? Which is just when you have just a black screen and a blinking cursor and mm-hmm. nothing happens unless you type in the code and you have to type it in perfectly. Like you miss yes. a semicolon and nothing happens.
Correct.
Oh my God, that must have been so much fun.
It was. And like such, I didn't realize this is in the book, but how much, if you tell a computer programmer, I want a program that does X, and you give that to five different programmers, they're probably going to come up with five different programs that from the user point of view, all do X, but their logical architecture of their brain of commands is totally unique. And so I thought that was really interesting to think about.
You know what? I love that you're saying that. So I've done just a little bit of programming, coding, just a little. And that always sticks out to me is because I would try to present my code or talk about it or find the bug and someone would come over to help me and they'd be like, wait, why did you use this logic? And we're trying to get to the same end, right? And what I had on the screen didn't make sense to them. And it's like, just see it my way, please. And I think that we've seen sort of an evolution a little bit. And you show that in the book, Homebound, that there is a little bit more of an understanding that maybe there's not always one way to get to that ending, right? And that's sort of the point of the choose your own adventure game. So did you also read a lot of choose your own adventure books?
I read quite a few. I also played text-based adventure games, which are what's in the book, this sort of choose your own adventure via computer when I was a kid. In fact, the earliest Oregon Trail was a choose your own adventure.
I played every day in the eighth grade. I was dying of dysentery.
Yes, I died of dysentery many times. So I played a good number of those games, and I liked that sense of, you know, the player is in conversation with the game. There's like a back and forth that's happening between them, and that kind of participation, that sense of electricity that happens when information is flowing both ways. I wanted that to be present in the book.
But it's also this idea of what is home? How do I find home? That was it for me. How did you think about the unifying or the string, the themes that brought them all together?
It was that around like what is home and how do we find our sense of belonging and place. I think as I was editing and working, I also had like plot-based questions that I was making sure got answered and wanting to make sure that there was a sense of, you know, you get to the end and you understand Bex is ending and then maybe you see things differently from the rest of the book because, of course, her storyline ends chronologically before anyone else in the book has begun.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Portia Alon, and we are talking about her brand new debut novel, Homebound. This novel links three women across centuries through a computer game. It's a novel that explores the meaning of love and interconnectedness across time. Portia, I thought you treated the fact that Uncle Ben died of AIDS just the way it would have been treated in the 80s. Like, it wasn't really named, but it was described. And he was never really recognized as a gay man by his family, but he had a really good friend, right? And just the way you talked around it all was so perfect for the 80s and not at all how we would talk about it today.
Thank goodness. You know, I read a few memoirs, and they were particularly written by gay men in the 1980s about not just their experiences with AIDS and sort of what their community was going through, but about the reactions of the families of their community, the like blood family, and that kind of silence that was used to tamp down any kind of real conversation showed up in those memoirs. And then I think I was not a teenager in the 80s. was born in the 80s. But that kind of silence, that kind of it's not polite conversation really persisted through the 90s. I would say even through the early 2000s. So into my adolescence and my awareness of what it meant to be gay, what it meant to be a part of that community. And so I think I layered it backwards.
Yeah, I mean, the way you describe it is the way people would have talked about in the 80s and 90s. Uncle Ben got sick and sicker, and he had pneumonia, and he had all these male friends. And I don't know, it just felt very real. And I'm glad that we are now able to say, right, no, he was a gay man and he had AIDS. A lot of the publicity around this book is 80s nostalgia. And it's not just the music and Tower Records and, right, the computer programming. It is this, you know, the AIDS epidemic and what was happening there silently. I want to dig into one of my favorite characters, Yessico, the sea captain. I just loved her. Can you introduce us to Yessico? Tell us all about her.
Yessico is the captain of a boat called Babylon, and she is a scavenger. She is a smuggler. She'll kind of do whatever she needs to do to stay afloat in her boat. And she sails with her only crew member, a man named Root, who is an older man who has kind of been a bit of a father figure to her. And Root, prior to the book's beginning, has had a pretty serious accident, and Yessico has gone into deep debt for medical intervention to save his life, and that medical intervention is now failing. So she really is setting out to save Root.
Root is really her found family. So she's on this mission to save Root because he's all she has, in a sense. And I felt so sad for her that Root was it and this boat. I mean, this boat was everything to her. And so there was a sadness to it, but also such a strength in her that she was willing to do what it took and to welcome new passengers and a new crew. Let's talk about that, the new crew members that arrive and join her on the Babylon.
Yeah, so at the beginning of the book, Yessico takes a job, which is to transport two teenagers named Shula and Tove and their companion, Chaya, to a town in the far north, farther north than Yessico has ever gone before. And at first, she is very resistant to having anybody else on her boat and feels a real sense of trespass, even as her new crew members or her visitors try and help, try and do things to assist or repair on the boat because the boat is kind of falling apart in some ways. And she feels a real protectiveness around Babylon and Root that means she can't at the beginning accept help from anyone else.
But this is where we get to Chaya, the robot, and we get to see Chaya really like with Yessico. So we've got my two favorite characters and Chaya starts to fix things. And this is where I start to realize that Chaya is more than a robot, that Chaya has a consciousness. And my question for you is, so is Chaya a prophet figure or is it a malfunction, right? Like, what's going on?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, prophet in the sense of like foretelling our relationship to technology? No, I don't think so. I think that Chaya's consciousness and the cause of it, I think that's a great question for readers to figure out in the book. I think Chaya's role in the book is really about illuminating how humans respond to what is different than us. How do we recognize and be in relationship with an intelligence, with a world, or with a being that is not like us?
And what makes us human?
Is Chaya human? I mean, in that sort of way of like, not in a human body, but like, what do we count as a human?
And so what would be home for Chaya?
In some ways, I feel like the whole Earth is home for Chaya based on their original programming, which was to take care of environments, to go in and do autonomous environmental sort of maintenance to fight back against climate change. I think by the end, Chaya has found home on Babylon with the people who are on Babylon.
Portia Alon, thank you so much for joining me here on Check This Out.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out. Next up, the Book Biz. This is where we talk about the forces shaping what gets written, published, and read. Today on the show, Rachel Cantor, founder and owner of Lovestruck Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We are going to talk about the world of audiobooks and how they are driving book sales. Rachel, welcome back to the Book Biz.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
And huge congratulations to you. You guys at Lovestruck Books just won Best Bookstore, Best of Boston. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was the Boston Globe, and we were listed alongside 11 other fabulous bookstores in the Boston area. So just very honored to be in such great company.
Amazing. Rachel, audiobooks, they are so much more than a narrator just reading from a page. Right now, we get full-on productions with sound effects, full casts, the works. In a way, they kind of remind me of old-time radio, but like,
yeah,
it's a performance, and I absolutely love them. So talk to me, like, how do you describe to people the world of audiobooks today?
A lot of people ask, you know, do you consider listening to an audiobook to be reading? And some purists think that it's cheating to listen to a book. I think consuming the content of a book in any form counts as reading. And also, like, who cares? Like, who's keeping track of that? But yes, I think audiobooks are no longer a side format. I think for a lot of readers, they're actually like the primary way that they're experiencing books. And then there are some authors who are actually releasing audio first, and then eventually they'll get a print run. But like, not only is the industry changing in that it's often going to digital first, now it's going to audio first. One of my favorite aspects of this is how immersive and like full circle this world is. Often what you'll have is a book, and then there's a TV show based on that book, and then the actors who play those characters on the TV show will then go record the narrator for the audio version of the book. So you can truly like consume it in multiple formats and experience these authors in multiple ways.
I also love it. And from what you're saying, it sounds like audiobooks are then expanding the book market.
Oh, yeah.
Because you have a book, and then it becomes an audio production, and it becomes a movie or a TV show, and then it becomes another audio production. So it's actually expanding sales.
Yes, audiobooks are completely like expanding this industry. And often people who are audiobook fans, like that's the primary way they're consuming books. And so again, like often people will listen to it first, and then they'll maybe want to go buy a physical copy if they really loved it. Like, I think what's so wild are these, you get these like audio book drops from these authors. It's almost like when a pop star releases like a secret bonus track or something like that. It's totally like for the fans, like for those loyal followers, you get this gift. And often those will be shorter. Those will be like novellas. So it'll just be 3 or 4 hours instead of a full book is usually like somewhere between 12 and 16 hours or something of listening. Part of why these audiobooks are so appealing is not only is the production value incredibly high. I mean, you talked about like how it's sort of similar to radio and that you've got sound producers, and not only is it the narrators talking, but you've got sound effects, you have soundtracks playing in the background, like it's a full-blown production. I think the quality is really excellent. And then also, everybody is always like walking around with headphones on anyway. People commute to work, people either, you know, public transportation or driving. And there's just a lot of time that we have to dedicate to listening, you know, while you're doing something else.
So let's talk about how these amazing productions are actually driving sales. Like, how do you see that effect in your bookstore, Lovestruck Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts?
Some of these audiobook narrators are also authors. And so one way that these audiobooks drive sales is that if you are a really big fan of some of these audiobook narrators, you will then go on to purchase their books themselves. So one example is Julia Whelan, who is a really phenomenal and popular narrator. She does all the Kristen Hannah books. And she has a book called My Oxford Year that's a fantastic romance. And then it was turned into a full movie. And so her being known as an audiobook narrator is driving sales to her work. There are also other examples of this where you have authors who are screenwriters or script writers for the audiobooks who then will write their own book that then sells really well. I've also seen increasingly authors who are writing with a view towards adapting their book either into an audiobook or a TV show. I think the way that books are getting written now, too, is with an eye towards converting them into audiobooks eventually, or even simultaneous with publication. I think that lends itself to witty banter, probably like less exposition. I think that's also one of the reasons that romance lends itself so well to audiobooks, because it's so character and plot heavy. You're really able to like get immediately into the action of the story when you're listening to it, which I think is a more effective way of listening to content. I think if it's really long on heavy exposition, you might lose your listener a little bit.
But what I love hearing you saying is that these audiobooks are expanding the market, right? We are growing the book business with audiobooks. I mean, this is incredible. Like, think about what you just said. So Kristen Hanna, people, you might be listening on an audiobook, and then they go and buy the book if they loved it. So they have a trophy on their shelf. And then they say, I love this narrator, so I'm going to go and look into her and buy her books too, right? And then she also has an audiobook. So it's like it's an ever-growing universe. And I think this is just a crazy change in the book business.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's almost like these audiobook narrators are tastemakers. Like the actors who do these really popular audiobook narration, the books that they're choosing to narrate, those become bestsellers because people are really committed to following those actors. And so, you know, you will have people who are like, oh, I'll listen to anything that Tom Hanks narrates, or I'll listen to anything the most recent pop star is, or, you know, actor who has been in a recent TV show adaptation. People are really committed to sort of like following their favorite actors. And so that can spread across multiple genres, and certainly is expanding readership because the narrators are reading across multiple types of books.
That is wild. I never thought about the narrators as tastemakers. We had Ron Charles on the show on The Book Business a few weeks ago. He was the former books editor at The Washington Post before that entire section was deleted. And I was asking him, and I was asking him, how are we going to find books in the future? Like, who are the tastemakers? And that idea never came up, that audiobook narrators are the tastemakers. Like, that is wild.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like whatever projects Reese Witherspoon is greenlighting for Hello Sunshine is probably going to be a really big deal. These audiobook narrators are maybe not quite on the same level as Reese Witherspoon, but increasingly they're becoming really well known. And so they are, yeah, they're dictating what's going to be popular. And this isn't totally new, right? Like, we all know and love David Attenborough's narration of, you know, nature documentaries. Like, I'll watch anything that Morgan Freeman narrates or whatever, but it's coming in this different format.
Yeah, it's totally different. And you actually introduced me to another part of the industry that is expanding that I am watching very carefully. There's a new business called Quinn. And Quinn is a subscription service, and they're basically a set of short stories, and they get famous like narrators to come in and read. So most recently they had the stars from Heated Rivals come in and do a story, and now we have Off Campus couples coming in. And again, people are flocking to Quinn to hear these, I don't know, are they novellas, whatever you want to call them, right? A couple hour long productions, in order to hear the narrators. And they've got to become books next, right? Like, they're going to publish these.
So Quinn is this incredible platform of audio stories, and often they are getting the actors from these well-known TV show adaptations to then go narrate these books. This is where it comes in, sort of this immersive experience comes full circle. So you've got often audio first or digital first stories that are then getting turned into TV show adaptations. And then sometimes the physical book is coming as a third and final step. Again, almost like a trophy for people who have loved these stories first. And sometimes these stories are coming straight from fan fiction that people are finding off of websites, and they're being adapted into full-fledged novellas.
So do you have people coming into your store, Lovestruck Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and saying, all right, I was listening to this book and it's about blah, blah, blah. Like, what is the name of the book? Like, where do I find it? Do you have people who do that?
Yes. Yes. I mean, the joke among booksellers is that we'll often have customers who come in and are like, I'm looking for this book. It has a horse on the cover. It, you know, and I think the author's name starts with a P. And so then we're kind of like, okay, is it, you know, is it Whistler by Ann Patchett? And it's like, yes, it is. But we often have to do a little bit of digging to figure out what book people are talking about. But yes, now people are coming in and they're like, all right, I'm listening to this audiobook and it's got two narrators, a man and a woman. It's dual point of view and it's about, you know, two rival journalists. And then we have to do a different kind of digging to figure out like, all right, some audiobooks have two narrators, some only have one. So like we're filtering based on different inputs now.
So funny. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rachel Cantor. We're talking about the book biz and audiobooks and how they are changing the book industry, how books are selling, being sold, being made. Are audiobooks changing how books become successful?
I think so. I mean, you know, I think often people sort of compare them to podcasts and the phenomenon of podcasts, that those have really become their own market. And I think audiobooks have also really become their own market. And I think it also speaks to the way that we consume information now. I mean, often you'll have content playing kind of in the background while you're doing other things. You know, it's really hard to read a physical book and do anything else. It's hard to be walking down the street reading a physical book, et cetera, et cetera. And so audiobook really allows people to multitask in a way that still allows them to like fit reading into their busy lives, but they can do it while they're doing other things. So I think that's part of why it's so popular and also why it's expanded this readership, because people who traditionally have been like, oh, I don't have time to sit down and read a physical book are now realizing, oh, I can actually do it for 15 minutes while I'm walking to get coffee.
So I love that you're bringing this up, because some of my favorite book talk videos show women doing things like, you know, I don't know, walking for coffee or like pretending to vacuum or telling, you know, saying like, I need time to myself. And they have their little earbuds in or whatever, and they're listening to their favorite novel. And like, it's this whole genre of like sub entertainment under audiobooks. And they play little clips of like, you know, their favorite narrator while they're pretending to do something. Like, it's amazing. These worlds that are generated from audiobooks.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, the joke is that somebody is like really caught up in their audiobook and they're, you know, they're pouring tea or whatever and they stop paying attention and the tea like overflows their cup or they're like, you know, they're vacuuming and they've been vacuuming the same spot for 20 minutes because they're so caught up in whatever's happening in their audiobook. But I've also started seeing ads. This is like a very funny ad trend where it'll be two actors walking. They both have headphones in, they bump into each other, the headphones drop, they pick up each other's headphones, and then they get to hear what the other person is listening to. And there's one ad with Sam Heughan from Outlander, and I can't remember who the woman is, but she picks up his headphones, and it's him giving himself affirmations that's like, you are cooler than this woman. You are better than this woman. You are as famous as this woman. And then when he listens to her headphones, she's listening to like, you know, Malcolm Gladwell or something like that. That has like nothing to do with him. So also this sort of like the insight into what people are listening to, which I think often feels even more private than reading or an ebook, because there's no visual cue to what you're listening to, can be really telling. Like finding out what is on somebody's audiobook list is a very revealing piece of information.
So yeah, I want to be clear that you sell audiobooks as well as physical books.
We do. It's not a huge part of our business. I think partly because it's a little conceptually hard to get your head around. But yeah, you can actually purchase an ebook and download it. The more traditional route is to do it through affiliate programs like Libro.com.
And if you're not going to buy it, there are also all these subscription services that are playing them. Like, I know people are also listening to audiobooks on Spotify, YouTube. YouTube is a huge source of audiobooks. Crazy.
Well, I mean, a lot of people do it from the library. I mean, that's probably if you're not purchasing it, the place that most people I know are downloading audiobooks is from the library. And that's hugely helpful for the authors because they're paid per download. And so that's a really great way to support some of your favorite authors, too, is to download their books from the library. So that's a place that's really popular. And then increasingly, a lot of these apps have proprietary audiobooks. So like Apple Books has proprietary audiobooks that you can only get through their platform. So again, back to our conversation about how it's changing the business, I think companies are seeing this as a way to sort of expand their product offering too.
So 10 years from now, let's like try to look into the future a little bit, if we can, or 5 years from now, do you think people are going to be discovering books and stories through audio more than print? Like, what do you think that balance is going to be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we haven't even talked about this, but there are now Audible physical brick and mortar stores where you can go in, and they just launched their first one. And it's basically a sound booth, and you go in and you select which story you want to listen to. And then they have these like listening booths. And so it's like an old school record store, except instead of a record, you're listening to an audiobook. But yeah, I think increasingly people are trying to figure out other ways to enhance discoverability. And so I think these like physical brick and mortar spaces where you can kind of browse the label or the cover of these audiobooks is a new way of discovering these titles.
As we talk about this, I just keep going back to the introduction where I described audiobooks and the way that they're being produced as entertainment now is really a throwback to like old time radio, right? Where you have everybody on the stage and you would gather around and you would listen and they were stars, but you never knew what they looked like. It was all about the voice and the feeling, right? And the pure entertainment factor. Like, I don't know, it's crazy that it's kind of this throwback.
The best example I can think of is Julia Whelan, who's so well known as an audio narrator. And then she was able to sort of translate this into a really successful romance novel of her own, My Oxford Year. So that's one great example. I think other examples of this are less about breakout stars and more about people kind of transitioning their career. So I think we've seen some folks who have maybe been character actors for a long time and maybe are not getting starring roles, but they are going gangbusters in the audiobook world. There's one example, the voice actor who plays Cassian in ACOTAR, has a huge following because he is such a draw in and of himself, this actor, this voice actor. He is an example of somebody who was kind of given this platform as an audiobook narrator and has now turned it into kind of being an influencer.
How are audiobooks changing the economics of publishing?
So often audiobooks are less expensive than a digital or physical copy of the book. And so people are often sort of faced with this decision when you get to the checkout point, whenever you're purchasing something, you can select what format you want it in. So you can select digital, you can select physical, or you can select the audio. And so depending on if you're price sensitive, that might impact the format you're choosing it for. And then also sometimes it is impacted by the release date. So the audiobook is not always released at the same time that the book is published. Sometimes it's after, sometimes it's before. And so that in some ways is actually sort of a catalyst for more spending. Somebody might want to purchase the physical copy after listening to it. So they're actually buying the book in two formats.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned earlier that a lot of people are listening to audiobooks through the library. But speaking of the economics and how authors are getting paid there, I've often found that audiobooks are available in the library. Like, I've never not been able to get an audiobook and often have to go on a very long wait list for either a digital copy or a physical copy of a book.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't know if that's because libraries have are offering more audio downloads than digital downloads. I actually don't know the details behind that, or if it's just that because this is an emerging market that maybe it's not quite as popular. People have been reading and consuming digital books for a long time. I think the audiobook is a little bit more of a boom. So that's part of it. But yeah, I agree.
But it's part of the industry changing. Like, maybe in another year or two, it's going to be harder to get the audio from your library and easier to get the digital copy or the physical copy.
And it also, as ever with with the book industry and the book business, it varies by publisher. So some publishers are, you know, charging standard retail pricing. Some publishers are trying to incentivize this. And so they're offering discounted pricing. So it totally varies. And then there are also these memberships. There are these like digital and audiobook memberships where you get access to thousands of titles for a monthly fee. And so that's also a very popular way that people consume the content and encounter the content. I mean, that's where people are sort of shopping.
Do you at Lovestruck Books make more money when you sell an audiobook or a physical copy?
Physical, partly because of, again, like we know the discount, we know we're getting a guaranteed profit margin from our publisher when we sell a physical copy. The audiobook is a little bit more variable. And also when you're buying the physical copy of a book, you are likelier to then want to purchase something else to go along with it. You're going to want to buy a bookmark. You're going to want to buy a cover for your book, something like that. And so it kind of leads to more purchasing behavior.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out. My guest today is Rachel Cantor here on the Book Biz segment, but we're going to move into summer reading recommendations. Rachel, what is a book that you recommend for people to pick up for the summer?
So one book that I am recommending this summer was just recently published, and it's called The Misconnection by Tia Williams. And it's actually about a casting agent who is looking for a stranger she met on a flight to Paris. She ends up hiring a detective who sort of bungles the search and potentially creates a love interest. And like all of Tia Williams' books, it's sexy, it's witty, it's very emotionally honest about sort of the risks of, you know, trying to find love. There are themes of healing.
I am a huge Tia Williams fan. Like, if she wrote it, I'm in. I'm reading it.
Yes, she is. She is an auto download for me as well.
Do you have another summer recommendation you can offer?
I do. Okay. Villa Coco by Andrew Sean Greer is one of my favorite summer recommendations. This also recently came out. He is the Pulitzer Prize winning author of Less, which if you haven't read is hysterical. It's a great summer read too, because it's a travel book. But Villa Coco is about a young American who takes a job in Tuscany as an assistant to an elderly baroness named Coco. And he has sort of a chaotic summer dealing with guests, and he gets entangled in Coco's plan to find a lost love. And he's doing this all while he's sort of navigating his own, recently graduated coming of age story. He has an affair with a married man. And like Andrew Sean Greer's other writing, it's hysterical. It's delightful. This is a perfect summer book.
I love Andrew Sean Greer and definitely his newest book, Villa Coco. I actually got to meet him at an event about a month ago, and I gushed to him about my favorite book of all times that he wrote is called The Impossible Lives of Greta Wells. It's about a grieving woman in 1985 and through electroshock therapy. I think she goes back to like parallel lives with a twin, and it's an amazing book. I love that you've also read it, Rachel.
Yes, he is so talented.
Yeah. All right. One more summer recommendation. Do you have another?
I do. Okay. My last summer recommendation is Every Summer After, which came out in 2022. And this is this was actually Carly Fortune's, I think this was her debut romance novel. And this was about childhood friends to lovers, whose relationship is sort of explored over the course of six summers, focusing on their first love. And then there's a falling out and then a second chance romance in adulthood. And this book was just adapted to a TV show that is streaming right now that is really fabulous and I think is going to probably be a top viewing option for many of us in the coming weeks. And if you like Carly Fortune, she also has a more recent book called Our Perfect Storm.
Okay, so first of all, I have to admit that I stayed up too late last night watching Every Summer After. And she is also, I just read everything that she writes every time. Rachel Cantor, thank you so much for joining me here on the Book Biz on Check This Out.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure as always.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna. You've been listening to Check This Out, a show where I talk to other writers about their brand new books. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. Our producer is Jessica Hunt, and HPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission, is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. This show is sponsored by CNS Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies,
the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books we're talking about this season. Thanks for listening. Read on.